And I'd now like to call on Jared Callahan and Lynn Elkins, who'll be speaking on scenarios and stress testing. So while they're making their way up to the stage, I'll just introduce them for you. Jared joined Deloitte as a director. Come up, guys. This is Jared here. He joined Deloitte as a director in June 2013. Previously, he was based in London. And Jared then spent the last 12 years in the life insurance and banking industry in the UK, working for large actuarial consultancies and a global investment bank. His main areas of expertise include life insurance capital requirements, designing and implementing board communication and information management strategies, asset liability management, and Solvency II implementation, including the ORSA requirements. And Len, over there. Len has been with Deloitte Actuaries and Consultants since 2008, and he works primarily with the life insurance and wealth management practices. Len's been actively involved with Deloitte's initiatives around LAGIC and risk-based capital. So please welcome Lynn and Jared.
Thanks, Bazena, for that. So Lynn and I will try and do a double act here in a very short sort of 15 to 20 minutes, covering a topic which I'm sure is very topical to everyone in the industry at the moment, and that is stress testing. So the way we'll run this is sort of look at what we mean by stress testing, very fairly generic term, but we can break that down into three types. We'll look at that. We'll look at where it can be useful, where people are finding it useful in the industry. We'll then move into a little bit of a case study strokes thought experiment, which Len will take us through. Then look at sort of the what the industry is doing at the moment. So we've spoken to a number of insurers on where they are with stress testing, how they're finding the process, is it adding value, et cetera. Talk through a little bit of that, and then move into an international perspective of stress testing. So what are some of the international insurers doing around it? So quite a full agenda, but we'll try and keep to the high-level points and move through as quickly as we can. So starting out then, so what is stress testing? Again, a generic term. Some people like to have formal definitions. That's one example. So there's a range of techniques to assess the vulnerability of a portfolio to exceptional or severe but plausible events. There's really three types which we've seen used to very different extents in the industry. There's the one we sort of all know quite well, which is sensitivity analysis. So that is the way we think of it, changing a single parameter. It might be a claim parameter, might be an expense parameter, and looking at the impact on something like profit and loss, embedded value, or surplus capital. But it's doing it one at a time. We can then extend that into scenario analysis, which is potentially changing more than one parameter at the same time, but going a little bit further than that and doing what we call these thought experiments of a severe but plausible scenario. So this is not trying to predict what will happen. It's not trying to do a forecast, but it's really thinking out of the box, what is something that could genuinely happen, perhaps something that hasn't happened in the past as well. So it could be scenarios around, and we've seen this used in the industry, pandemics, industrial action, terrorism, various out-of-the-box scenarios that you can change several parameters at the same time. And then there's the very topical one, and this one was very topical in the UK through the GFC, which is the reverse stress testing. So this is really looking for the point in either financial or demographic assumptions, which basically you can think of it as breaking the business model. So it's to the point where you're either breaching your PCR or breaching even the policy liability and really understanding those breakpoints. I remember I was on secondment to quite one of the big international insurers about a decade ago, sort of when in the early 2000s when the FTSE was falling through the floor, and the appointed actuary would come around to the team saying, guys, are we still solvent? And so at that point, we started doing reverse stress tests on the basic parameters like equity, interest rates, and so on, and eventually fed itself through into very formal regulation, which is what we have at the moment. So that's a very quick summary of what stress testing, how we could look at it in the three different types. I thought it might be useful to ask the question of why do we do it? Why is it valuable? And there's a whole raft of reasons, but really what it does for you is it helps you understand how the business is moving through a business cycle or different types of conditions. It can help you validate your models. So, for example, models used for the logic calculations or even into economic capital models really help you validate the underlying assumptions to those models by changing the environment in which they're operating. We've seen a lot of use of it for testing the ICAP across the industry, being used to validate capital triggers and test management actions, probably still in its early stages, but testing the management actions and looking at the ability of the company to respond to those scenarios that you're looking at. Also, it can be used a lot for evaluating risk appetite statements. So that would be running a particular scenario which you've thought at completely separately and asking the question, does this actually fit within the risk appetite? So you could have situations where an adverse scenario is actually within the risk appetite and perhaps it validates whether the statement is actually the right thing to have. It can also help you look at, this is especially in projected scenarios, so looking at capital emergence over a period of time, sort of looking at what the timescales for recovery from a situation might be. It also helps assessing non-viability of parts of the portfolio. So this is looking more at the reverse stress testing, what would need to happen before different product lines or parts of the portfolio become non-viable. Do you need to change the product mix, perhaps change the asset mix even? And then validating some of the methodologies that are used. A lot of the regimes, LAGIC, Solvency II, in the basic standard formulae calculations use the correlation matrix approach. Some of the big internationals are using other methods which capture tail risk a little bit more accurately than the correlation matrix approach might do. And some will use scenarios of testing combined movements to see what would happen in the tail. In other words, you know, two strong stresses in an extreme position adds up to a lot more than a simple addition of the two. So looking for those non-linear impacts. And then there are a range of second-order impacts that doing these three types of stress testing can help you understand, which is in a stress scenario, looking at how the business would respond, so looking at availability of reinsurance in a crisis, thinking about how competitors would respond. So is there a danger of almost a winner's curse in some sense, and looking at scenarios like that, and also thinking about whether there'd be a need to raise more capital and what the cost would be. So a range of things there. So I don't know, Lynn, if you can talk through quite an interesting example.
Okay. So what we'd like to do now is talk about when stress testing, when it's poorly executed, can actually lead us astray. So following a review of the internal scenarios adopted by Australian ADIs a few years ago, APRA observed that too often the scenarios and the modelled results are not enough to result in substantial losses. This disaster myopia needs to be overcome. In other words, financial institutions need to seriously and dispassionately look at those scenarios that can undermine their capacity to remain solvent. If we step outside the financial context and look at the lessons from the recent Fukushima disaster, we can gain some useful perspectives into what we might refer to as disaster myopia. In March 2011, a magnitude 9 earthquake produced a tsunami that struck the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, leading to flooding which eventually led to core meltdown at three nuclear reactors. Following the incident, it emerged that the operator of the plant, which was TEPCO, had chosen to disregard an internal stress test that exposed the plant's vulnerability to tsunami waves exceeding 10 metres and urgently recommended improvements to the retention walls to protect against flooding seawater. The study noted that a magnitude 8 earthquake was strong enough to produce a 10-metre wave and cited seismological evidence from as recently as 1896 and 1933 from that general geographic area. Unfortunately for Japan, TEPCO's management chose to basically disregard the findings, dismissing them as being remote the possibility of a 10-metre wave scenario, even under a magnitude 9 earthquake. So what can we do as life insurance practitioners to try and reduce our own risk myopia? I think firstly we need to acknowledge that we are constrained by a paucity of stable data. So unlike seismic activity, which develops at a geological scale, the behaviour of financial markets and human mortality tends to be far more rapidly evolving and dynamic. The impacts of financial innovation, globalisation and medical developments are difficult to predict and can introduce a material discontinuity between past and future trends. Consequently, for us as practitioners in life insurance, unlike for geologists, our assumption setting is as much of an art, which requires creativity, as it is a science. Second, we should remain sceptical of the predictive power of our modelling, particularly when we investigate the tails of our distribution. Unlike seismologists who deal with a single causal relationship between an earthquake and a tsunami, financial models need to contemplate dozens of uncertain and often dynamic interactions, including systemic failure and contagion. The risk of model error in our profession is compounded, and we should materially expect that things can become substantially worse than we might otherwise than our models might otherwise suggest. Third, stress testing processes should ideally consider scenarios which eliminate in-force profits and expose the balance sheet to loss. Expected shortfall analysis, which is a study of how much worse things can get after a particular adverse scenario, may help validate the appropriateness of our target capital position and our management actions and capital triggers within the ICAP. According to the official investigation into the Fukushima disaster, the 14-metre wave that struck the power plant was twice as high as the modelling had suggested, and consequently, there was an erroneous assumption that the emergency systems that were relied on during an ordinary course of event would be adequate to actually then ameliorate some of the impact. Lastly, I think we need to acknowledge that life companies do not have access to unlimited capital. And noting our earlier comments regarding the systemically important insurers, there's clearly value in policymakers and the regulator understanding those risks or those scenarios that are beyond the industry's financial capacity and those scenarios that might therefore become an issue for the regulator or policymakers to actually manage should they occur. So just for a little bit of a change in direction, in preparation for this participation, we met with some of our life insurance colleagues to gain some insights into how the industry is responding to the new stress testing requirements that are outlined within the ICAP and where the industry is generally at in terms of implementation.
Yeah, so speaking to about, I think it was about six or so of the insurers over the last few weeks, I think it's fair to say that overall, stress testing is in a fairly early stage of development. It's very much seen as a journey. However, we were at least reassured to see that in most companies, they have undertaken a pilot scenario. A lot of companies, as I mentioned earlier, are looking at pandemic scenarios. So that's not purely the impact on claims, but wider impacts, even into operational impacts of sort of people not being at work, etc. So a lot of companies looking at that. Unsurprisingly, I guess, there's quite a large overlap in the types of scenarios people were considering. Most were looking at economic downturns, and the pandemic scenario came up time and time again. Interestingly, I guess, there were differences of opinion on the value of stress testing. Some companies saw the exercise as the value is still to be realized. reason being they're still developing the thinking, around management actions in particular, and could see a lot of value coming about when they bedded that in and understand really where they were with that. Some companies saw a lot of value because they were starting to think about where the breakpoints are in some of the stresses. So that's more the reverse stress testing aspect. Others felt they wanted to understand and step through a particularly onerous scenario that would undermine viability of the whole organization. We were actually interested to see that there seemed to be a difference in the severity of scenarios. I think Adrian mentioned this a bit earlier. So by no means are they all at a particular percentile. Some components of the scenario were a lot weaker than the sort of logic requirements. Some were a lot stronger, and companies sort of taking the view that for the risks that are most material to us, we'll stress those at a percentile beyond what's sort of required by the standard. And in other cases where risks are less material, they wouldn't focus so much on those scenarios. So there's definitely a mix of severity. And then a variety of considerations given to the wider commercial context. So one particular company was actively considering competitors, how they would behave in those stress scenarios. But that wasn't something that was mirrored across the industry. Some were considering risk mitigants in those scenarios, how they would respond to them happening, thinking about things like reinsurance, thinking about things like changing asset mixes, thinking about payout ratios, etc. But again, that's one that's not quite bedded down across the industry from the conversations we were having. Amongst the life insurers owned by banks, a lot of them have group scenarios that they need to run, but had some discretion in altering those to fit the profile of the risks within the life co. And then we talked to them a bit about engagement.
Okay. I might just speak to this very quickly and just go to the final slide. But in terms of board engagement, we saw a sort of a divergence of approach. On the one hand, we saw some good examples of boards taking an interest in both the development of the scenario as well as the sort of the process of going through and doing the quantitative analysis and discussing the risk mitigation strategy. And on the other side of that, we saw perhaps a little bit more of an informal approach where management was largely left to undertake the work and then to basically report it to the board in the first instance. And I think the view there is that because this is a fairly new requirement, at least formally, that sort of as a pilot, that approach might be appropriate.
And so then to conclude, I guess, international perspective. So stress testing in its various forms is a formal part of many regimes, be they insurance-related, such as Solvency II and the Swiss Solvency Test, or the banking Basel III and the Dodd-Frank Act. The PRA in the UK, formerly FSA, has reversed stress testing as one of their key requirements and discussed quite a lot with the bigger insurers. And it's used very much by the big international groups when planning out their capital management and their business plans for the entities around the world. It has come about strongly from a compliance perspective, but it's increasingly forming part of the general risk management framework in the international insurers. And just the last point, that there has been significant investment in this, particularly in the UK, which was my background, in sort of rebuilding models and removing manual processes and finance transformation process to be able to answer the what-if questions that boards might have. Thank you.
Thank you.